Welcome to Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. I'm Connie Thiessen. It's like Andrew Cash's whole life has led up to his new role as the president of the Canadian Independent Music Association, with roots in the Toronto punk scene before going on to a successful solo career and eventually getting elected as the Member of Parliament for Toronto Davenport. Cash has long been an advocate, not just for independent musicians, but anyone trying to make a living in the arts. On this episode of the podcast, we welcome Cash to talk about taking the helm of CEMA as the Canadian music scene faces an uncertain future, the organization's push for a more flexible CanCon definition, and his take on controversial amendments to Bill C-10.
Hi, I'm Andrew Cash, and I am the new president and CEO of the Canadian Independent Music Association. I come to this role after pursuing many winding paths, and they all seem to actually be pointing in this direction. I was a longtime musician, singer, songwriter, performer, producer, toured all over Canada, the US, the UK, put out a bunch of records. And I also, at various points in that career, did a bunch of writing for the Toronto Weekly Now magazine. And all of that experience was incredible, and it taught me a lot. But I started to think a lot about my situation as an independent artist, as a jack of all artistic trades, a freelancer, a contract worker. And I started to think about, you know, how precarious it is to work this way. And I was looking around for, you know, who else was talking about the way I work, the way people in the arts and culture sector work, or people who are solo self-employed. And I couldn't find anything. It started to bother me. And I listened to the public debates about work, and they were dominated by the conversation around a formalized employee-employer relationship. And I couldn't relate to that. And I suspected there were a lot of people out there who worked like me, you know, couldn't access health and dental benefits or sick leave or minimum wage or employment insurance. And the list goes on and on, actually. Anyway, that got me interested in trying to bring some of these issues into the public forum, and I decided I would run in the 2011 federal election as a NDP candidate here in Toronto. I won that election and had an incredible 4.5 years in Parliament, and really pushed these issues. I suspected that people in Parliament, both the politicians and the bureaucrats, didn't really have a sense of what it's like to earn a living in the arts and culture sector. That was my hunch. And I have to say, in all humility, that my hunch was totally correct. People really, really don't know. And it's a culture there dominated by people who have stable full-time jobs with a defined benefit pension and all of that stuff. And so I really tried to punch through with this conversation. I didn't win that the next election, but I wanted to keep doing this work. So I co-founded a small nonprofit called the Urban Worker Project, which was there to raise the issues and the voices of contract workers, solo self-employed, freelancers, generally independent workers writ large. And we did a lot of skill sharing and skill building and advocacy, public advocacy. And, you know, all of that work, which is really just really important to me, and, it's diverse experiences, are really the kind of skill set that was required for this job, running the Canadian Independent Music Association. And so I'm delighted and excited and honored and energized to be in this role. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can do.
It really does seem like you're uniquely positioned to take on the leadership of CEMA, but your roots are in punk rock. And so I think that, you know, sort of shift into politics and advocacy is natural, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, It's funny you should mention that, because this is maybe day 22 for me. And I really care about the independent music sector. Like, it's in my bones, you know, that's what punk rock's about, is that DIY mentality. It's like, we can do this. We don't need the man to do this. We don't need anyone to tell us that we can do this. We can just do this. And, you know, many of the members of SEMA have that ethos too. I mean, most people who embark upon some kind of creative venture in music have to have that kind of attitude, really, because it's tough to survive, and you have to have that attitude. You have to have that drive.
So, speaking of tough to survive, paint a picture for us of the situation for a lot of the SEMA membership right now. How have the first few weeks on the job been?
Well, you know, the membership is pretty varied, I have to say, you know, because we do have labels who are members, independent labels, and even among the label community, the reality and the types of labels and the levels that they're at are all quite different from you know, very large labels who have offices internationally, to real lean mean startups of one person. So we've got that, and we've got a bunch of managers. We have some artists, entrepreneurs, people in the recording sector, and so it is quite varied. But fundamentally, as you know, it's not going to come to as a surprise to you, but COVID has really taken the sector out at the knees. Just about everyone's revenue is down significantly. Some of the labels down upwards of 80%. Managers have lost, you know, a significant amount of revenue that was on their books for 2021. And the artists, well, actually, before I get to the artists, there's all the infrastructure around the artists, you know, the roadies, the sound people, the lighting people, you know, the drivers, there's all of them. And then the artists themselves not being able to play live. I mean, it really underlines, you know, a lot of the economic, well, I'm going to use the word precarity one more time in this interview, the economic precarity of this model that is predicated on live performance for the artists to survive. I think it's fair to say that the CERB, emergency benefit that the federal government created after the first wave of the pandemic, has been basically the lifeline for most people in the arts and culture sector. And as that starts to wind its way down, government just announced that they'd like to wind this thing down by the end of September. That's, you know, raises a lot of questions. I'm really concerned about that date. Now, you know, mind you, there's the government's also pumped a ton of money into Heritage Canada to sort of bridge the gap, I think, between the end of September and whenever we get out of the pandemic. So it's an open question right now as to how that money is going to get dispersed to the community.
Right. Quoting the Canadian Live Music Association, their estimates indicate a $233 million drop in revenue. That's just the independent music sector. 64% of the live music industry at risk of permanent closure, and a 92% revenue loss. Is there a clear path to recovery at this point, or is it all still too uncertain at this juncture?
There's not a clear path. Definitely not. If you just think about where everyone is today, right? And you're a manager of a band, you're a band, you're a label, and you're trying to plan, what, a tour in, you know, 3 months, let's say. Well, you don't know whether you're going to be able to do that. You know, there's no guarantee that anything's going to be open in 3 months. And even if we get a handle as a country on the pandemic, you know, by the end of June, middle of July, it's still very unclear whether we'd be able to travel outside of Ontario, let alone outside of Canada. I think, let me back up. I think when the first wave came, everyone just thought it was going to last maybe a month or so. And so people were kind of pretty buoyant and just like, wow, this is weird, but we'll move on as soon as we get a handle on it. Now, it's more like, well, we don't know when we're going to get through this. And that's really affected people's ability to plan things. And, you know, when we did that study that you're quoting, that was a SEMA study that was done before my time, but it was done in the first wave, and that number, 233 million. But it's increased significantly in the second wave and third wave, right? So the losses are really massive. One of the messages that we're trying to bring, especially to our government partners, is that the support for the recovery is going to be every bit as important as the support that's been there just to keep people hanging on throughout the pandemic.
Well, there was $20 million in the federal budget aimed directly at the music industry, but does that even make a dent in these huge revenues?
Yeah, that's true. There's been more money actually in this recent budget, but there's no doubt. You know, look, the sector was in need of a larger shot of government investment before the pandemic, and then the pandemic hit. And that really, you know, that really put things in a dire spot. I think on the live side, that's where it seems really up in the air what things will look like when this thing's over, because anything that has anything to do with mass gatherings has got a big question mark looming over it right now.
Broadcasting and radio have always been a part of that independent music ecosystem. Do you see a role for radio in the post-pandemic recovery, or what could stations be doing now?
That it's tough for me to totally say. I've had my head down for the last 21 days getting accustomed to what we're doing at SEMA. But yeah, there's no doubt that the partnership's been strong there between music and the radio stations. I think there's a lot of stations with a significant voice in their own communities, you know, and one of the things that we're participating in right now is a campaign around vaccine hesitancy and trying to dispel some of the myths around this. So when we've got enough vaccine for everyone, that, you know, everyone or as close to everyone as possible gets it. So, I think there's a real role for any institution or organizations that have a public voice be participating in that sort of thing.
Staying with radio, SEMA was involved in a joint submission as part of the CRTC's commercial radio review, which actually recommends a more flexible approach to the definition of Canadian content and the MAPLE system. So for those who don't know, for radio purposes, MAPLE defines how Canadian something is according to four criteria: music, artist, performance, and lyrics. Do you want to talk about those changes, Andrew? The way they phrase it in the document is creating more pathways to eligibility.
So when you think about how a lot of music is written today, it's really tough to say. It's, you know, only music that has a very clear one lyric writer and one music writer. Music just isn't written that way often anymore. There's oftentimes multiple people involved in the writing of music, in the production of music. Someone who's written some of the lyrics, some of the music, and is the producer or the engineer. Part of it could have been recorded in Los Angeles, and part of it could have been recorded in Scarborough. What we're trying to do with our recommendation is to reflect the reality of music today, and also to understand that you know, the MAPLE system makes it harder for certain types of music, certain racialized communities, to get access to listeners because this current system doesn't really reflect their reality at all.
And obviously the process of recording is much different because people are making records on their laptops in their bedrooms.
Absolutely. I mean, really, like, could anyone have imagined 40 years ago, A, that we would be doing this, even this podcast, the way we're doing it here, you know, let alone how music is made, how music is marketed? It's just an incredible revolution. And, you know, frankly, I think we're just at the beginning of just massive technological transformation. And so, you know, there's no doubt that the Canadian music business and the explosion of it over the last 4 years, the CanCon Maple system really contributed to that. And we've developed incredible artists and audiences. But we need to move into the modern era. Our submission also reflects, the voices that traditionally have been left out: Indigenous artists, BIPOC artists, female artists. And we are suggesting that those communities are counted in the system as well.
As I'm sure you're aware, Bill C-10 is back in the headlines. You previously served on the Canadian Heritage Committee and the Special Committee on Copyright Act Reform.
You have to remind me of that.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on the direction of where this legislation is headed.
Well, I think it's headed in the right direction. You know, you've got streaming services that are, they're sort of radio 3.0 in a way, and you've got international platforms like Netflix competing with conventional broadcasters here in Canada, but none of them have any of the responsibilities or obligations that broadcasters, radio stations, Rogers, Bell, they don't have any of the obligations that other companies or other broadcasters have. And I think that C-10 rightly is trying to bring those digital service providers into the structure of the Broadcasting Act. In other words, to level the playing field to the degree that it's possible to do that. And in broad strokes terms, I think there's some really good things in here. And so we support it. With amendments, we've suggested some. But, is C-10 a perfect bill? Well, I don't know. What? Of course not. But what is, other than awesome music, what really is perfect out there in life? I see the direction that the government is going, and I think that I think the intent, the overall intent of leveling the playing field, bringing the DSPs, these international mammoth companies who pay no taxes and contribute no funds into Canadian content development, while everyone else has to, attempting to bring them in is important. It's important for the not just the music sector, obviously film and television too.
Right. I mean, the buzz this week, or concern, I guess I should say, is because of the removal of the exclusion of user-generated social media content that you might upload to TikTok or YouTube. Right. Where is that line between free speech and the copyright strike?
Well, I would like to, first of all, humbly, how do I say it, suggest that maybe that's not quite what's happening here. As I've just said, the government's trying to bring, the Spotify's and the Apple Music's and the Netflix's and the Amazon's of the world into the structure of the Broadcast Act. So what's the number one source of music in Canada right now is YouTube. So the initial writing of the bill excluded social media companies. And then they realized, well, wait a sec. If we're bringing, Apple Music and Spotify into the act, but leaving out the biggest one, that's ridiculous. So the clause in the bill that exempted social media, social media companies, was removed. But what wasn't removed was protection for the people who use social media, who upload user-generated content. So that's why I'm saying I respectfully disagree with your interpretation. It's actually the people who, the regular Joe Blows, anyone like you and me who are uploading cat videos, we're still going to be able to do that. The clause that was taken out was the exception for social media companies to be part of the act. But there's still protection for people. It's right there. It's clause 2.1, if you really want to get into the weeds. And it's basically very clearly states that if you're a person using social media to upload programs for transmission over the internet and to be received by other users of a service like a social media platform, that does not put you into the structure of the act. In other words, you just keep on doing that, but you can't. How can you have rules for Spotify and Amazon and Apple Music and not have rules for YouTube? It just would not work, right? So I really think that those that are opposing Bill C-10 for a variety of different reasons thought they had an issue here that they could torque, create some mayhem and some tension and some stress for the government, which they largely were successful in doing. But I don't think that at the end of the day, the argument is going to hold at all.
Congrats on your new role, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thanks for listening to Broadcast Dialogue. For more information about the podcast or to receive exclusive access to our weekly briefing about the Canadian media industry, visit us at broadcastdialogue.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, connect with us on LinkedIn, and follow us on Twitter and SoundCloud.
I'm Matt Kundle, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.